For people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Jen Rogers for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Smithsonian. Smithsonian is generously supported by the Kepin family. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from Smithsonian, the magazine of the Smithsonian Institute. On today's program, we'll start with an article titled Grubhub by Mary Roach. Inexpensive to raise and insatiably hungry for trash, black soldier fly larvae are already on the menu for livestock, pets, and maybe soon, people. It's mango season in Kenya. Evidence of this fact is heaped two stories high outside a greenhouse on the outskirts of Nairobi. A 900-ton mound of mango detritus reeking sweetly in the February sun. The mango is waste from a processing plant, but it won't in fact be wasted, because just beyond the heap, inside that greenhouse, are 128 million creatures that like their food rotten. They are maggots. Specifically, they are larvae of the black soldier fly, being reared by Insectapro, one of Kenya's largest black soldier fly farms. Once they mature, the larvae will be made into protein meal, used in animal feed. A 2021 review article counted 950 published papers on the use of edible insects, such as the black soldier fly, for fish, for poultry and pigs, for crustaceans, for rabbits. If you search the online magazine Pet Food Processing using the keywords black soldier fly, 136 articles come up. Are maggots the superfood of the future? Nina DeGroot, Insectapro's head of operations, would say yes. Right now, American adults get about two-thirds of their protein from animal products. Those animals feed on crops like corn, barley, and oats, which require huge quantities of land, water, fertilizer, and pesticides. Black soldier fly larvae are a more sustainable alternative and offer a nutritious food source for pets and livestock. More humans may be eating them, too. Companies are looking into selling protein bars and shakes, ice cream, and falafel mix made with the black soldier fly larvae. DeGroot is 30 years old, dry of wit and long of leg. If you have in your head an idea of a maggot farmer, I wager it does not align with Nina DeGroot. The day I visit, she's wearing a cropped black sweater and high-waisted linen pants. The greenhouse is filled with black plastic boxes that contain ground mango goo and the larvae that are devouring it. The boxes are stacked six or seven high and arranged in neat rows. One operation I read about referred to this sort of setup as the modular fattening system. I mention this, DeGroot laughs. It's crates. She sets one out so I can see what's going on inside. Fattening, eating, is, for the maggot, an athletic activity. It's a mad, striving competition for the best seats, close to the food but away from the light. In 2 hours, DeGroot says, holding a mango, this is completely gone. The collective hoard consumes 16.5 tons of crop waste a day. The black soldier fly larva is a voracious eater, because it has to be. Upon waking from its shape-shifting pupatory nap, the black soldier fly will never eat another meal again. Feast while you can, youngster. For the rest of their short lives, the flies must rely on the fat and nutrients they took in as seething grubs. They are a living pantry for their own future selves. Thus, BSFL, as the larvae are known among those who work with them, are a highly concentrated food source. This, in part, explains their tremendous potential as animal feed. Also, they are cheap to raise, vertically farmed, and content to live on waste material no other industry wants. Low-quality input, high-quality output. Of the $2 billion invested in insect farming to date, over half of that has funded black soldier fly farming operations. Black soldier flies are especially efficient processors of waste. They have a high feed conversion rate, a closely watched metric in the animal feed industry. According to May Walraven, general manager of U.S. operations for Inova Feed, the world's largest producer of black soldier fly larvae, everything you feed them turns into live biomass. In contrast, she says, a chicken has a feed conversion ratio of 3 or 4. Over the span of its life, you have to feed it 4 times what it will weigh at the time you harvest it. There is no published feed conversion ratio for humans, but a back-of-the-envelope calculation that includes you, reader, have a ratio closer to 4 to 1. Further contributing to the black soldier fly's popularity is the speed with which the larvae grow from speck to full-size grub. It is the equivalent of, as one industry website puts it, newborn to blue whale in 2 weeks. We stand for a moment watching the squirming mass. It's kind of hypnotic. De Groot says to me, you can grab some and hold them in your hand. Nothing happens. She revises the statement. I can put some in your hand. It's nice. A little massage. She's correct. It's a featherweight version of an automated massage unit. I'm relieved to find the larvae are not slimy, though the relief is undetermined somewhat by the feeling I recognize from each time a child has handed me a hamster or guinea pig to hold and pet. The low-grade dread of being pooped on. After a few seconds, I tip the larvae back into the crate and inspect my palm. There are a few tiny smears which a cursory rinse doesn't entirely remove. Multiply this by 128 million small smears, and you have the 9 towering piles of larvae excrement, or frass, behind the greenhouse. The plan is to sell it as a soil amendment. The demand has not yet caught up to supply. We are joined by InsectaPro founder and CEO, Talish Wiegebers. Without thinking, I shake her hand. Wiegebers directs my eye to an experimental plot of corn that has benefited from BSFL fertilizer. She says farmers have reported a 28% average increase in crop yields. Why, then, aren't they lining up at the gate to buy it? Kenyan farmers are wary. In 2024, bags of government-subsidized, quote-unquote, fertilizer turned out to be diatomite, a kind of sediment used in insulation. The government literally sold them bags of stones, Wiegebers says. 6 workers in orange jumpsuits are working the nearest pile. The frass needs to compost, so the crew must turn the pile, shovel load by shovel load. On the topic of turnover, is it hard to find people to do this work? De Groot says it isn't, and that the smells don't bother her. Not the rotting mango smell, not the frass, not even the stench inside the insect breeding area. To encourage females to settle in and lay eggs, InsectaPro lines the bottom of the fly enclosures with time-tested blend of rotted vegetable matter deemed just below gag-worthy. What, you may or may not be wondering, is the appeal of stinking matter for a fly? The nutrients and decomposed material are readily available. Bacteria have had a head start on breaking down the nutrients, taking a load off the eater's digestive tract. In the Journal of Insects as Food and Feed paper, Upcycling of Manure with Insects, Current and Future Prospects. The decomposition ecologist Jeff Tomberlin and his colleagues write that adding poultry manure to the fly's diet can increase their larval weight by 75% and decrease their development time by 2 days. On a small scale, it's possible to envision a completely zero-waste circular economy. Let's say you keep chickens. You can feed maggots to the chickens and feed human waste to the maggots, while using the chicken, the maggots' own waste to manure to grow more produce. A local luxury establishment, the Ololo Safari Lodge and Farm, has had success with this. Safety regulations in the United States require commercial operations to feed larvae pre-consumer food waste to avoid introducing pathogens. In some ways, it's a shame, because if they were fed livestock manure, it would help keep it off the land and out of the water. Though manure is valuable as a fertilizer, large farms produce more than can be used. A manure processed by BSFL is less pathogenic than one might assume. Larvae naturally live in and ingest legions of bacteria, the drivers of rot, and for this reason have evolved powerful antimicrobial defenses. What's more, they appear to pass these defenses onto livestock when they consume them. A paper Tomberlin co-wrote mentions a study in which hens-fed BSFL meal had, compared with hens-fed traditional feed, lower counts of E. coli and other bad bacteria, and higher counts of lactobacillus, good bacteria. According to a 2020 review paper in the same journal, insect additives in poultry and crayfish feed have at certain levels been shown to diversify the gut microbiome. Pigs might benefit similarly. Studies have shown that piglets receiving BSFL supplemented food have fewer bouts of diarrhea and healthier immune systems. Bleachers outlines the advantages of animal feed made with BSFL. In a small experiment undertaken by InsectaPro, with the cooperation of a local pig farmer, five pigs fed a diet supplemented with BSFL were ready for market about 2 months sooner than the usual. The exoskeletons of the larvae contribute calcium and chitin. If you feed chickens BSFL, the eggshells are stronger, so there's less breakage in transit, Liegeburg says. Chitin is good fiber source and may have digestive benefits. Using feed made with insect protein provides a nice sustainability narrative as well. Insect farming uses a fraction of the resources, land, energy, water, that it takes to grow corn or soy. Given these benefits, are American poultry and pig producers switching to feed made with BSFL? Not yet. It comes down to cost. Animal feed is a low-margin business. Soy and corn are cheap, heavily subsidized, and grown on a massive scale. It's really hard to do something at a large scale and compete with commodities, says Walraven, the general manager of the French-based company InnovaFeed. And sustainability is not typically a prime concern among large-scale pig and poultry operations and the feed producers that supply them. The situation is different in Kenya, where the soybean and corn supply struggles to meet demand, and the high cost of feed puts pressure on farmers. The appetite for InsectaPro's product is high, too high, Wiegeber says. The company is currently contracted for almost 2,200 tons of product, which she says will take her at least 5 years to deliver. The InnovaFeed facility in Nesle, France, has a production floor area the size of 8 soccer fields. It has an annual output of 25,000 tons of larvae. Imagine 2 Boeing 747s of maggots per week, Walraven says, memorably when we speak by phone. Who in Europe is buying all this insect protein? Fish farms are a key market. More than half the world's farmed Atlantic salmon comes from Norway, and the alternative protein source, wild-caught feeder fish, are being exploited by overfishing. For now, the market in America is not fish feed or poultry or hog feed, but rather pet food. This initially surprised me. Our pet parents, as many within the industry call them, A-OK with maggot in the dog food bowl? And if pets are eating insect protein, will their parents be far behind? In 2023, InnovaFeed broke ground on a pilot facility in Decatur, Illinois. It is far smaller than the company's French operation, perhaps a single Piper cub of maggots per week, with plans to scale up gradually. A French facility is much more server farm than insect farm, fattening crates stacked 8 high, tended by robots. With the exception of 2 employees in a control room, the processing of the larvae is automated. The insect's life cycles are tightly timed, such that an entire generation matures at the same rate. Sensors detect when the grubs have stopped feeding in preparation for pupation, at which point they're tipped into funnels that sieve out the frass to be made into fertilizer, and move the larvae along to be cleaned, killed, and processed. It's about as factory as farming gets. The company has a sizable advantage over other entrepreneurs is that they have partnered with agrobehemoths Archer Daniels Midland, ADM, in Cargill. A pipe runs from ADM's Decatur corn processing facility directly into the Innova feed plant. And through the pipe flows the wet corn waste that InnovaFeed feeds its larvae. ADM will then purchase the larvae to put in certain brands of the pet food it sells. It's circular economy on a corporate scale. The fact that it's wet waste is key to both companies' environmental messaging. The energy it would take to boil until the liquid is gone from thousands of gallons of corn processing waste or to truck it to 100 miles away would be immense. With this arrangement, neither is needed. InnovaFeed's main hurdle in the States is psychological, since it's selling directly to the public rather than to agricultural feed producers. The company recently announced that it was taking an 18-month break from production in the U.S. to focus on developing that pet food market for developing the pet food market for our ingredients. Walraven states the obvious. People are put off by insects. InnovaFeed has developed a label for its partner products that says powered by Hylusia. Hylusia is a portmanteau of Hermetia and Eleusians together, the scientific name of the black soldier fly. Walraven doesn't see this as deception. People eat pork, not pig, she points out. There's a separation between the animal and the ingredient. We felt like it would be helpful to have that separation. Walraven also feels the naming is justified given the InnovaFeed's product is unique. Chicken meal is basically chicken meal, she says. Hylusia is not just any BSF. It's the one we developed with all the R&D that went into it. Also, chicken meal doesn't have its own mascot. Lucia, the Hermetia Eleusians, is the only BSF with an Instagram fan base. Even with the spruced up nomenclature, marketing teams have their work cut out. According to the ADM survey, pet parent perceptions of insect protein in pet food, just 23% of Americans polled said they were likely to feed such a product to their cat or dog. After the benefits of insect protein were explained, that number rose to more than 30%. Time will tell. Dogs themselves appear to have no problem with it. In palatability studies, foods made with BSFL meal and oil performed as well as or better than those made with traditional protein sources. Like black soldier flies, dogs are generally not known to be finicky. Their owners can be a different story. Premium products that include human-grade, hypoallergenic, and even vegan food are among the fastest-growing in the U.S. pet food market. Will pet food brands made with BSFL appeal to humans who don't eat meat? If they're avoiding animal products out of concern for the environment, then quite possibly yes. But it's out of concern. But if it's out of concern for animal welfare, hard to say. BSF larvae do not like temperatures above 113 degrees Fahrenheit, and hot water submersion is one method used to kill them. No one is quite sure whether their nervous system is sophisticated enough to feel pain or whether instead the movement is a simple reflex. Insect welfare is one topic being investigated by members, including InnovaFeed, of the Center for Insect Biomanufacturing and Innovation. More prosaically, dog owners of all stripes will appreciate BSFL's performance vis-a-vis the Purina Fecal Scoring Chart. The turds of dogs fed food with either 15 or 30% maggot protein average between a 2, firm but not hard, leaves a little or no surface residue when picked up, and a 3. Log-shaped leaves surface residue but holds its form when picked up. A score considered ideal by the pet food industry. BSFL paste dog food, according to one company-funded study, also improves oral health. When dogs were fed a diet of 29.5% BSFL protein, which the manufacturer coyly identifies as protein X, they had fewer stink-generating bacteria in their dental plaque than when they were fed a diet of poultry byproducts. Their median breath score valuation went from slight but clearly noticeable to barely noticeable. A nuance arrived at by a panel of dog breath sniffing odor judges. Ask Walraven whether, given the health and environmental benefits of BSFL protein, people too will be eating foods that incorporate it. She was for a time in charge of InnovaFeed's exploratory efforts in the human food realm, running test kitchens and consumer tasting panels. Dried BSFL meal has a nutty, bitter taste that Walraven likens to unsweetened cocoa powder. She says it tasted great combined with chocolate, say in a shake or a protein bar, a likely bestseller one would think, given the current mania for all things protein. However, it doesn't taste sufficiently great that InnovaFeed is going forward with the product. The company stopped looking into it 2 years ago. It's a big step to going from feeding the dog to feeding yourself, Walraven says. For whoever goes first, it'll be a huge effort in terms of marketing and education. Because of the challenges of competing with corn and soy, InnovaFeed has been trying to increase yield by encouraging farmed black soldier flies to mate. Lighting has been shown to make a difference. So might sound. Staff experiment with frequencies, volumes, even vocalists. Black soldier flies' reproductive rates are perhaps the last metric where Barry White outperforms Beyonce. InsectaPro has its own breeding research facility, an airy tent with thousands of adult flies and tall screened enclosures. The whole soldier fly life cycle is here. Egg, larva, pupa, adult. The first thing you notice upon stepping inside, after the smell, is the silence. They're a very chill fly, Weegeburr says. Their name makes no sense as they're not aggressive. They don't attack or kill anything or sting. They are more delicate than houseflies. The lower half of their legs are white, like a schoolgirl's knee socks. In short, the black soldier fly is an unusually appealing fly, possibly a world-changing fly. It makes you wonder, as de Groot says, how we as humans decided that we associate only bad things with insects. Insects are one of the most important things in this world. It is insects, along with bacteria and fungi and other of nature's malign players, that break things down and create nutrients for plants. Even houseflies, I say. And people just want to kill them. Those guys are much better than houseflies, Dweegeburr says, making the case. They don't transmit disease, they don't hover annoyingly around your face. And because they don't eat, they don't get all up in your picnic food. The Groot nods cheerfully. We hate houseflies. Next, we'll move on to an article in The Past is Prologue, American Icon this time, titled Playing It Cool by Ted Scheinman. A century after his birth, America's most inventive jazz man can still take your breath away. Miles Dewey Davis III's first memory was a blue-hot flame on the family stove. I felt fear, real fear, he recalled in his 1989 autobiography. He was also exhilarated. That blue, he said, presented an invitation, a challenge. Afterward, I had always believed that my motion had to be forward, away from the heat of that flame. Davis was born to a prosperous middle-class family in Alton, Illinois, on May 26, 1926. The next year, the family moved 20 miles or so down the Mississippi River to East St. Louis, or East Boogie, as it came to be known because of its crackling music scene. Davis's father, Miles Davis Jr., was a dental surgeon. His mother, Cleota Henry Davis, was a violinist and a pianist, and tried to steer her son toward classical music. But Davis, the second of three children, heard more fire in jazz. He started cornet at 10, got his first trumpet at 13, and met his first girlfriend, Irene Berth, when he was 15 or 16. The Davises didn't approve because she came from the Goose Hill neighborhood with its slaughterhouse and stockyards, and its smell of burnt meat and hair, Davis recalled. The two fell in love, and Berth provided crucial encouragement. In 1943, she persuaded Davis to try out for the Blue Devils, a band where he played what he called hot dance music, and did his first arranging. Next year, he left for Juilliard School, and Berth and their first child, Cheryl, soon joined him in New York. Davis was a so-so student at Juilliard, spending nights in the clubs from the village to Harlem, drawn by the flame of bebop, according to his biographer, John Zwed. He was keen to meet the two architects of this brash new style, trumpeter Dizzy Gillespie, and especially saxophonist Charlie Bird Parker. Davis buttonholed Parker outside the Heat Wave, a club on 145th Street. By the end of 1945, Davis had dropped out of school and scored a spot in his idol's quintet. He likely recorded more trumpet with Parker than even Gillespie did, and he made substantial contributions to bebop. But he wanted to blaze a path of his own and did so by bringing an intimate attention to tone and phrasing. I prefer a round sound with no attitude in it, like a round voice with not too much tremolo and not too much bass, Davis said. For further understatement, he sometimes used a partial mute in the bell of his trumpet. At the 1949 sessions, later released as Birth of Cool, the Miles Davis sound emerged, forthright, eloquent, and plaintive, as if lamenting that this was the closest you could get on trumpet to the human voice. It was urbane, perceptive, always ready, but never hurried. In short, to use a word whose full meaning we owe to Davis, it was cool. While Berth and Davis never married, They had three children by 1950. Bills mounted and Davis's ascent slowed as he served a heroin habit. He kicked dope a few times, suffering days and nights of sweats and chills. In 1954, he got clean in earnest. The next year, Columbia Records signed him and bent its marketing apparatus toward making him a superstar. And Davis formed a breathtakingly versatile quintet that included John Coltrane on tenor sax. And boy, could Davis work a band. As the great critic Stanley Crouch wrote, this historic combo stoked fire as ably as it crooned. In the two sessions released in 1959 as Kind of Blue, Davis introduced unfamiliar melodic scales into jazz, and what might have been an obscure modal experiment instead became the biggest jazz album ever recorded. Davis took the wartime sound of bebop and turned down the volume and heat without sacrificing intensity. He'd made a new and beautiful kind of Cold War art, bringing acoustic jazz to such a point of perfection that when he introduced electric guitars, a decade later, many critics, especially Crouch, treated it as the vilest heresy ever. They were wrong. Davis's fusion bands were often brilliant, but so what? Davis trained as a boxer, for fitness and for protection. He was obsessed with Jack Johnson and Sugar Ray Robinson, and imitated them outside the ring, dressing sharp and driving fancy cars. He was legendary for the epithets he delivered in his frying rasp. To say the very least, his relationship with Berthe and his three subsequent marriages to Frances Taylor, Betty Mabry, and Cecily Tyson, each an artist in her own right, didn't survive his tempers. The anger that was bound up with the prejudice Davis battled all his life. He refused to play segregated shows, and was once beaten and arrested for talking back to a white policeman outside a club where his name was on the marquee. He also battled brutal health problems, particularly toward the end. Despite tremendous pain, he maintained a burning curiosity for new music, creating new fusions whenever he played. On September 28, 1991, he ran out of breath. His last studio work, Doobop, a hip-hop-inflected album, released the following year. Today, 100 years after his birth, some folks still resent Davis for being hard to pin down musically. Many purists hate his 70s music. Why was such a genius to base himself with rock? Many more hate his 80s music. Why was Miles Davis covering Cyndi Lauper? Olu Dara, a cornetist whose son, best known as Nas, became one of the most influential rappers in history, put it this way. Miles was dealing with all that America has to say. He makes you a true American. We've run out of time for today's episode of Smithsonian, generously underwritten by the Kepin family. We hope you've enjoyed listening. Please join us next time. I'm Jen Rogers, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Smithsonian is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.